You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
So if you are feeling whiplash watching the crypto charts right now, you're certainly not alone.
Not at all.
We're navigating a market that is just fundamentally split in two. You've got this massive institutional fear that's driving all the volatility.
Right.
And yet at the same time, there's this incredible structural progress, these technological breakthroughs happening just under the surface. It's a real battle between panic and conviction.
It really is an essential period of transition. And, you know, the numbers, they tell a pretty brutal story about the short term.
They really do.
We've seen a market dip that in just 6 weeks wiped over $1 trillion off the total crypto capitalization.
A trillion.
Bitcoin hit a high in early October. What was it? $126,251. But that momentum just completely reversed. It fell sharply below $92,000 and even briefly dipped under that $90,000 mark.
And that drawdown, that just erased everything from 2025, didn't it? All those hard-won gains.
Pretty much all of them, yeah.
What's really remarkable to me about this correction isn't just the size of it, but the sheer speed.
The speed is the key.
Previous big market corrections, they took, 77 days, 147 days to inflict this kind of pain? This one did it in just 42 days.
That compressed time frame, it accelerates the fear. You can feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw that fear reflected directly in how the institutions behaved.
Absolutely. You just have to look at the ETFs.
Exactly. When you look at the exchange-traded products, mm-hmm. the panic is crystal clear. The spot Bitcoin ETFs, which, you know, were supposed to be the source of all this new stability and capital.
The safe money,
right. They saw record outflows. We're talking $3.1 billion flooding out in November alone.
Wow.
And the most startling data point, I think, comes from BlackRock's IBIT ETF. It recorded a single day record outflow of $523 million.
Half a billion dollars
fleeing what was supposed to be a safe, regulated vehicle in a single day.
And that right there, that sets up our core mission today. We have to unpack this conflicting narrative, because on one side, you have this extreme price stress, the institutional caution, you know, the canceled funds, the record losses.
All the panic.
But just beneath that, there's this quiet structural advancement happening. You've got regulatory frameworks solidifying, major infrastructure, you know, exchanges pursuing Wall Street IPOs.
And the tech integration.
Genuine technological integration from AI and trading to real world asset tokenization. It's all accelerating. It's the messy, difficult transition from, you know, a fringe asset class to a maturing financial ecosystem.
It's the difference between looking at today's closing price and looking at the multi-year construction plan for the foundation of the building.
Let's start with that institutional drama then, because you have these two stories of just staggering capital commitments. One is doubling down and the other is abandoning ship completely. We have to start with the Abu Dhabi whale.
Let's call it sovereign wealth conviction. The Abu Dhabi Investment Council, or ADC, they made a massive strategic bet. They tripled their stake in BlackRock's IBIT ETF during the third quarter.
And this was before the crash, right? That's the critical part.
That is the critical part. This move was completed just before the market tanked. In a way, they bought the fear before the dip even fully manifested itself.
Tripling a stake like that, that's not just passive investing. That's a high conviction, you know, directional trade. How big did their position actually get?
It grew from 2.4 million shares to nearly 8 million shares. So as of September 30th, that position was valued at roughly $518 million.
Wow.
But the value is almost secondary to their stated rationale. This wasn't framed as some kind of speculative trade. ADC characterized this Bitcoin allocation as a long-term diversification strategy.
That long-term view, I mean, coming from a sovereign wealth fund, that's profoundly important. What exactly are they comparing Bitcoin to? Is it just another tech stock for them?
No, not at all. They explicitly stated they compare the asset to gold.
To gold.
They expect it to play a structural role in what they see as an increasingly digital global economy. This comparison is a huge indicator for institutional finance, because gold is, you know, it's the ultimate geopolitical risk-off asset. It's a recognized hedge against fiat devaluation and political instability.
So for ADC to put Bitcoin in that same category, that signals a permanent shift in how sovereign capital is viewing this asset.
Exactly. It's not a temporary allocation for them. It's a new pillar of a global reserve strategy. This is them saying they see Bitcoin as part of the financial foundation for the future.
And this commitment, it's shared across the whole organization, right? Because Mubadala, which oversees ADC, they also have a huge position.
A huge position. Mubadala Investment Co. also holds a substantial 8.7 million IBIT shares. They're valued at around $567 million. So all in, you're talking about over $1 billion in sovereign capital, making a structural bet on Bitcoin's long-term status as a digital reserve asset.
$1 billion of deep long-term confidence. But then you have to contrast that with the other story, the proposed $1 billion Ethereum Digital Asset Trust, the DAT.
The complete opposite story. This is being championed by a heavyweight consortium of Asian backers. We're talking Hubi founder Li Lin, Shen Bo of Fenbushi Capital, Xiao Feng of Hashkey Group, and Kai Wensheng from Meitu Inc. A real who's who.
And this was poised to be an institutional behemoth, a corporate treasury vehicle designed specifically to rival the size of, you know, a Grayscale or a Bitmine, but focused only on accumulating Ethereum.
That was the plan.
What kind of capital did they actually manage to get together?
Well, that's the thing. The consortium had already lined up $1 billion in committed capital. Lee's Avenir Capital put in $200 million, and other institutional investors, including the very powerful Hongshan Capital Group, committed a massive $500 million.
So this was locked, committed money.
Yes. It was aimed at fundamentally changing the supply dynamics of Ethereum, just buying and holding.
That level of capital committed by that caliber of, you know, traditional and crypto-native whales, that sounds unstoppable. So why did they pull the plug?
It was called off. Completely. Sources familiar with what happened confirmed that the primary trigger for halting the plan was the market downturn. Specifically, the sharp sell-off on October 11th. The committed capital was just returned.
Wow. So $1 billion strategic venture just disassembled because of one bad week in the market.
That's it. And this is the clearest example we have of just how sensitive some of this committed institutional capital still is to short-term volatility. The Abu Dhabi Fund, they shrugged off the dip and bought more Bitcoin. The Asian consortium saw the ETH dip and immediately pulled the plug.
That is a devastating psychological blow to the institutional Ethereum narrative, isn't it? It suggests that the deep-pocketed ETH buyers are still fundamentally more speculative, more risk-averse than their Bitcoin counterparts.
It definitely highlights a difference in the perceived risk tolerance, mm-hmm. for sure. And we see that risk tolerance being tested even further with SharpLink Gaming.
Ah, yes. They were famously the first publicly listed company to adopt ETH as their primary reserve asset. But now they are facing a financial reckoning is the only way to put it.
A reckoning is right. When we talk about that, we're talking about $500 million in unrealized losses.
Yeah.
That number is just staggering.
It demands a closer look.
Indeed. SharpLink currently sits on substantial unrealized losses. Depending on the source, it's estimated between $479 million, that's according to SER data, to over $500 million, according to CryptoQuant data.
Okay, so just for our listeners, break that down. What's the difference between SER and CryptoQuant data?
Right, so SER data refers to securities exchange reporting that captures the book value the company reports to regulators. CryptoQuant, on the other hand, provides on-chain analytics. So it's measuring the actual real-time difference between the current price and their average purchase price based on their wallet activity.
So two different methods, but they both confirm the same thing. A massive loss.
A massive loss. And what's driving that liability is, well, unfortunately, poor timing. SharpLink's average purchase price for Ethereum is quite high. It's sitting around $3,609.
Ouch.
With ETH now falling sharply toward that critical $3,000 level, the stress on their balance sheet is immense. This is important because, you know, institutional holders often have debt covenants or requirements to maintain certain balance sheet ratios. Unrealized losses of this magnitude trigger some very serious risk management concerns.
At SharpLink, they had previously treated dips as buying opportunities. So what specific action did they take that has analysts thinking there's a major reversal in their strategy?
They made a very deliberate high-value move on-chain. They transferred 5,442 ETH, which is worth approximately $17.02 million, to Galaxy Digital.
And Galaxy Digital is a specialized over-the-counter or OTC exchange.
Exactly. And OTC desks are typically used for large volume private transactions, the kind you do when you want to avoid slippage on the open exchanges.
So if they're moving millions of dollars in crypto to an OTC desk, is the consensus that this signals an outright liquidation? Or, I don't know, could it be collateral for a loan, maybe to raise quick cash without selling the underlying asset?
That's a great question, and it really speaks to the nuance of reading on-chain data. While, you know, collateralization is possible, the consensus among analysts is leaning toward a risk reduction sale.
So they're cutting their losses?
It looks that way. Given the sheer scale of their total unrealized loss and the fact that they're moving the ETH to a third party known for facilitating these large private sales, it strongly suggests a major portfolio rebalancing aimed at reducing risk exposure. So yeah, cutting losses or raising fiat capital to shore up their operations.
So regardless of the immediate intent, this move, it just underscores the pressure they're under. Even the second largest institutional ETH holder and SharpLink still holds, what, 859,853 ETH?
An incredible amount.
They are demonstrating significant weakness. They are the definition of an entity being forced to react to market volatility, not act with conviction.
So we have a clear picture of this institutional fear and, you know, the contrasting conviction of sovereign wealth. Now, let's pivot away from that short-term market action and look at the actual physical and financial infrastructure being built underneath all this volatility. We're talking about the exchanges that are aiming for Wall Street.
And we have to be talking about Kraken, which has just taken a massive step toward becoming a publicly traded company.
Absolutely. Kraken confidentially filed a draft S-1 registration form with the SEC for a planned initial public offering. The fact that they filed confidentially that signals they're moving very aggressively behind the scenes and have secured the backing they need to pursue this.
And the valuation they secured just before this IPO filing was, I mean, it was truly enormous.
It was an $800 million funding round that valued the company at an astronomical $20 billion. But the crucial detail here is who backed this round.
Right.
Major traditional finance players. We're talking Ken Griffin, Citadel Securities, and Jane Street. These are not crypto-native venture funds. These are the deep-pocketed giants of Wall Street.
That backing Citadel and Jane Street, that signals immense confidence from TradFi that Kraken can actually navigate the regulatory gauntlet and compete head-to-head with a company like Coinbase. So what's the immediate goal of this IPO?
The filing aims to position Kraken alongside the other listed crypto firms and, most importantly, to fuel their global expansion. They're looking to extend their dominance internationally, using the IPO capital to build new product lines and secure additional licensing in key jurisdictions outside of the highly regulated U.S. market.
But the path to public market glory is, let's just say it's fraught with peril. And you can see that with what's happening with the Bullish paradox. Bullish completed its IPO at $37 a share back in August. And despite hitting major financial milestones, the stock price is really struggling.
It is a profound paradox. It really highlights the disconnect between traditional financial valuation methods and how the public markets are currently perceiving crypto firms. Bullish reported record adjusted revenue of $76.5 million and a net income of $18.5 million in Q3 2025.
That's a huge turnaround.
A staggering turnaround from the $67.3 million net loss they posted the previous year. So they are profitable, they're growing rapidly, and they're demonstrating successful cost controls, all the things Wall Street supposedly loves.
Yet, despite all this fundamental financial success, their stock is sinking.
Correct. Bullish shares dropped over 5% recently and are now trading below their $37 IPO price. They hit $35.87. The market, it seems, is just not rewarding proven profitable growth in the crypto exchange sector right now.
Why not? Is it just the broader market fear or uncertainty about future regulation?
It's likely a mix of both. The sentiment is just so negative that good news is being ignored.
So if profitability isn't enough to drive their share price, where is Bullish looking for their future growth?
Well, their CEO highlighted two major strategic areas. First, their options product has proven very successful. It's already surpassed $1 billion in trading volume. Second, and this is critical for the future of the entire sector, they are hyper-focused on real-world asset tokenization, RWA.
RWA tokenization. So taking tangible assets like real estate, credit, or commodities, and putting their ownership stakes onto a blockchain, why is that the strategic focus?
Because it bridges traditional finance and blockchain with tangible, predictable revenue streams. And to solidify this commitment to RWA, Bullish submitted an SEC application to be registered as a transfer agent for U.S. securities.
Now that is a massive regulatory step. For the listener, why is registering as a transfer agent such a significant regulatory hurdle for a crypto exchange? It sounds like boring back office stuff.
It sounds boring, but it's a huge deal. A transfer agent is responsible for tracking who owns a company's stocks, bonds, or other securities. If the SEC approves Bullish to act as a transfer agent for U.S. securities, it means they're essentially authorized to handle the back-end processing of traditional financial assets, but on the blockchain.
So it's a direct regulatory stamp of approval.
Exactly. It allows them to move far beyond just crypto trading and into the multi-trillion dollar world of digitized equities and debt. It makes them a foundational layer for RWA tokenization in the U.S.
This ambition, you know, contrasting with the short-term price fear, it ties into this bigger market psychology debate. Are we finally moving past the purely speculative phase of crypto?
The data suggests a definitive shift is underway. Market makers, like Enflux in Singapore, they observe that the market is rapidly moving away from being liquidity-driven, you know, relying on massive retail influx, excess leverage, and generic momentum, to being fundamentals-driven.
The old alt seasons.
Those traditional alt seasons fueled by pure speculation are fading, yeah.
So if speculation is fading, what does fundamentals-driven actually look like on a chart when the price is crashing?
It looks like divergence. You see tokens that are tied to clear utility things like staking yields, predictable revenue streams, approved ETFs, or RWA. They're holding up much better than the purely speculative assets. The weaker majors and the purely narrative-driven coins, they're the ones absorbing the majority of the selling stress.
So the market is becoming more discerning.
Exactly. It's a sign of long-term structural health. The market is prioritizing durability and utility over just, you know, reflexive beta exposure.
That shift towards structural durability is perhaps what Jim Cramer was seeing when he suggested it. Almost feels like a cabal is trying to keep Bitcoin above $90,000.
That comment perfectly encapsulated the market tension when Bitcoin was briefly dipping under that psychological $90,000 mark. But the community counterargument is crucial here.
Which is?
There's no manipulation. The support is entirely structural buying. Driven by clear math, we are seeing persistent mandatory ETF inflows combined with massive accumulation by corporations like Strategy, and this volume of buying consistently exceeds the new daily issuance of Bitcoin from miners.
And Michael Saylor has been the most vocal champion of this structural argument. He's been arguing that Wall Street's entry is actually making Bitcoin more stable, not less.
He is incredibly committed to this view. Saylor maintains that Wall Street's adoption through ETFs and corporate treasuries provides this predictable, deep source of demand that acts as a continuous floor into the price. I mean, Strategy currently holds an astonishing 649,870 BTC.
Which is worth about, what, $59.59 billion?
Roughly, yeah. And he has repeatedly called their leverage position robust. In his view, the market floor isn't arbitrary. It's being raised by massive, transparent, committed institutional capital.
But if the floor is being raised structurally, why did the price still dip so dramatically? Why didn't that structural demand just overwhelm the short-term panic and prevent the dip below $90,000 in the first place?
And that's the critical question that challenges the perfect stability narrative. While that long-term accumulation is mathematically raising the baseline, short-term volatility is driven by forced selling. You've got liquidations of leveraged retail positions, you've got ETF redemptions from panicked holders, and major corporate risk rebalancing, like we just discussed with SharpLink.
So the forced sellers create a tidal wave.
They create a massive immediate liquidity event that even the persistent ETF inflows can't instantly absorb. Saylor's long-term stability argument is sound, but it doesn't insulate the asset from acute short-term panic induced by leverage and unexpected news.
Speaking of structure, we have to address the major stress point within the Bitcoin network itself, the economics of the miners. The reliance on the block subsidy is hitting a critical level compared to the transaction fees.
This is a foundational concern for the Bitcoin network's long-term security model, which is, you know, designed to eventually rely entirely on fees to pay for security. Currently, Bitcoin miners get their revenue primarily from the block subsidy, which is 3.125 BTC per block.
That translates to about $45 million in daily revenue.
Right. However, the transaction fees paid by users, the payments for actually using the network, currently contribute only about $300,000 per day to miner revenue.
That is less than 1% of their total income coming from fees. That ratio seems, I mean, fundamentally unsustainable for the future of the network.
It represents a 12-month low for fee contribution, and it dramatically highlights the network's heavy reliance on the inflation-based reward system right now. And while the subsidy won't fully end until around the year 2140, this persistently low-fee contribution raises a very serious question about long-term miner economics.
Okay, so why does low-fee revenue matter if the price of Bitcoin is high? I mean, isn't the subsidy still worth a lot of money?
It matters because miners secure the network. They spend massive amounts of energy to validate transactions and prevent double spending attacks. If the block subsidy eventually disappears, the network needs fees to compensate miners for that security work.
And if the fees aren't there?
If fees remain negligible, if the network is mostly used for simple transfers rather than complex high-fee transactions, and the Bitcoin price doesn't appreciate enough to make those small fees worthwhile, miners won't be incentivized to spend the energy required.
Which could lead to a decrease in network hash rate.
And that could potentially expose the network to a 51% attack risk, which is when a single entity gains control of most of the network's processing power and can rewrite the ledger.
So we have institutional investors structurally raising the price floor, but at the same time, the underlying economic engine of the network, the fee generation, is showing long-term weakness. The infrastructure is somehow robust and fragile at the exact same time.
Moving from the Bitcoin fundamentals, let's look at the altcoin space, where the volatility is often amplified, especially around major institutional product launches. And we have to start with the first XRP ETF launch, which was a clear buy the rumor, sell the news event.
Yeah, it was positioned as this major breakthrough, but the launch by Canary was met with a resounding thud in terms of price action.
Canary launched their XRP ETF with a respectable $250 million in initial inflows, which, would typically be seen as really bullish momentum.
But not this time.
Not this time. Immediately following the launch, the XRP price dropped a sharp 9%. This just reinforces that earlier point. In a market under stress, even significant fund inflows do not guarantee price appreciation if the broader liquidity and sentiment remain fragile.
But this institutional access, it's not a one-off thing. There's a strong pipeline of major asset managers gearing up to launch their own XRP funds, right?
Absolutely. Franklin Templeton, financial giant, has their XRP ETF scheduled for launch on November 20th. Analysts are projecting anywhere from $150 million to $250 million in first-day trading. So there's clearly persistent demand for regulated exposure. And we also have active filings from Fidelity, Invesco, and Bitwise.
So institutional access is expanding rapidly, regardless of the initial price disappointment.
Correct. And meanwhile, Ripple itself is making moves on-chain. We saw a shift of $450 million in XRP to an unknown wallet. While the reason for that move is murky, the most high-profile XRP story involves the one and only Dave Portnoy.
Of course. Portnoy's conviction is once again highly entertaining and highly visible. During this market dip, he reported making a calculated $2.15 million dive back into crypto.
He did. He divided that capital. $750,000 into Bitcoin, $400,000 into Ethereum, and he committed a full $1 million to XRP.
And he called XRP his 10x bet.
His 10x bet. That's a significant vote of confidence in XRP's long-term utility, even as the ETF launch disappointed. His comment about hunting when there's blood in the streets really confirms his HODL conviction and his willingness to bet big on assets he believes are fundamentally undervalued, regardless of short-term volatility.
It's a pure high-stakes speculation play that contrasts so starkly with ADC's structural risk-off allocation.
A completely different mindset. And now, completely outside the institutional ETF race, we have the story of Zcash, which is delivering returns that justify the broader market fear.
A 1,000% rally since October is almost unbelievable. Zcash, or ZEC, it's soared from, what, $70 to now trading above $700 per coin? What on earth fueled this explosive price action in this market?
The primary driver is a dramatic resurgence in the privacy narrative. This rally has been accelerated by some celebrity endorsements and, I think, a growing global realization that centralized digital systems inherently lack anonymity. Zcash, with its superior zero-knowledge proof technology for shielded transactions, became the main beneficiary of this renewed interest in digital financial sovereignty.
How has that surge affected its market ranking?
ZEC's market capitalization has reached $10.1 billion. That places it within a 65% price increase of overtaking Cardano, or ADA, for a coveted spot in the top 10 rankings.
Wow.
And what's perhaps even more telling about its current momentum is its trading volume. In terms of daily trading volume, ZEC is already ahead of ADA. It's registering $1.71 billion. The narrative is strong, and the liquidity is flowing rapidly to support it.
That's a powerful reminder that utility tied to a deeply felt user need, in this case, privacy, can generate spectacular momentum, even when the rest of the market is in pain.
Now, contrast that strong utility-driven narrative with Shiba Inu, or Asia. Here, the price action appears to be driven purely by inertia and hope.
Right. We've seen massive outflows recently. Over 120 billion to 130 billion AJIB were moved to exchanges in just a 48-hour period, reflecting sustained selling pressure.
That kind of outflow should crush the price, yet it's sort of holding weakly above a critical threshold. Why the resilience?
Well, technically, the asset is not yet in a catastrophic oversold zone. Its relative strength index, the RSI, is staying above the critical 30 mark, which usually signals that rock bottom is imminent. This suggests that while there is a lot of selling, there is still some baseline momentum and a dedicated retail base that is absorbing the volume.
But the real scrutiny falls on the project's long-term promise, its deflationary mechanisms. Are they actually working?
It doesn't look like it. They are demonstrably failing to create scarcity at any meaningful scale. The project has long promoted burning tokens to reduce the supply, but the burn activity is nearly non-existent.
And the amounts are tiny.
The few transactions that do occur are minuscule compared to the overwhelming supply of over 589 trillion tokens still in circulation. The failure of this intentional scarcity mechanism means the token's price movement is driven entirely by speculation and community inertia, rather than any intentional utility or supply shock. So we've covered the market volatility, the institutional positioning, and the altcoin drama. Now let's accelerate into the technological revolution that is defining the next era of crypto, the intersection of AI, next-generation security, and real-world utility.
This section really proves that innovation is accelerating completely independent of price. And the biggest news here is the direct integration of artificial intelligence into mainstream trading. The crypto exchange Bytru is implementing this into its copy trading service.
This is a huge leap, allowing users to automate their investment decisions based on the analytical power of these massive AI models. Which models are they actually integrating?
They've integrated six of the leading large language and intelligence models: GPT-5, Gemini 2.5 Pro, Claude Sonnet 4.5, Grok 4, DeepSeek V3.1, and Qwen3 Max. Users can select any of these models and entrust a portion of their portfolio to automatic machine management.
That list covers the absolute cutting edge of AI development. What sort of performance track record are these models bringing from traditional finance?
Well, experiments conducted in traditional stock trading environments have shown some remarkable effectiveness. Models like GPT-5 and Gemini 2.5 Pro have recorded impressive success rates of 74% and 71%, respectively. They often outperform human fund managers under specific market conditions.
But the crucial question is how they will fare in the highly volatile, peculiar, and often narrative-driven environment of cryptocurrency markets, which often don't follow traditional technical analysis patterns.
Exactly. This is the first major real-world test of AI in mainstream crypto investing. Bytru is allowing users to define the portion of their investment they wish the AI to manage, but the profits and losses are entirely retained by the user.
So it's an interesting blend of decentralized investment control with hyper-centralized analytical power.
It is. This signals a future where these large language models might be the primary drivers of short and medium-term trading liquidity.
Moving from AI trading to a fundamental problem of crypto, securing your private keys. We're seeing a true disruption here with the GNOT biometric hardware wallet.
The GNOT aims to completely sideline the seed phrase, you know, the infamous 12 or 24 words that are simultaneously the key and the single point of failure for crypto security. It's challenging the established hardware wallet makers like Ledger and Trezor by eliminating the need for seed phrases or even PIN codes entirely.
How does GNOT achieve that level of security without a traditional key?
It uses advanced finger vein scanning technology, and this is far more secure than a standard fingerprint reader. Finger vein scanning works by reading the unique vascular architecture inside the user's finger.
And it requires live blood flow.
Crucially, yes. The technology requires live blood flow to unlock, which effectively prevents sophisticated threats from high-resolution static scans, molds, or, morbidly, the use of severed fingers. The core security mechanism relies on zero-knowledge proofs processed locally on the device, ensuring your biometric data never leaves the wallet.
That's a massive leap in physical security and convenience. I mean, it solves the single biggest fear for a lot of people, right? Losing that piece of paper with 24 words on it.
It does. And it supports all the major chains: Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, BNB, and XRP. Furthermore, the company is actively developing multi-sig functionality, which would allow the wallet to unlock only if multiple users, potentially located globally, verify their unique finger vein scans simultaneously.
And what's the price point?
The Founders Edition presale is priced at $299. They're betting that users are willing to pay a premium to eliminate the security nightmare of managing a seed phrase.
That solves a major headache for institutional and high net worth individual holders. Let's look at DeFi innovation now, specifically Falcon Finance's staking vaults.
So Falcon Finance launched these staking vaults to cater to users seeking higher predictable yield without giving up ownership of their assets. Users can deposit their holdings, starting with a native FF token, and earn yield up to 12% APR.
And this yield is paid out in their synthetic dollar.
Correct. It's paid out in USDF, their synthetic dollar, which is specifically designed for consistency and resilience. It aims to minimize the volatility risks associated with non-fiat-backed stablecoins.
12% APR is attractive, but what structural features are built into the vaults to ensure that consistency and resilience you mentioned? How do they stop a bank run?
Well, the design emphasizes orderly asset flow and prevents those rapid destabilizing withdrawals. The vaults require a 180-day minimum lockup period, ensuring liquidity remains stable for half a year.
Ah, okay.
And there's a 3-day cooldown period before a withdrawal can be finalized. This structure strengthens the underlying pooled liquidity and reinforces the broader USDF ecosystem by creating predictable capital commitments.
Now, this next story might be the most critical development in terms of real-world utility. Stablecoins finally bridging the gap to everyday commerce in major developing economies.
This is a monumental achievement for utility and adoption. MiniPay, which is a Celo-based stablecoin wallet developed by Opera, just rolled out a pay like a local feature specifically targeting Latin America. This innovation directly connects UST or Ecanor balances to local real-time payment methods.
So you're telling me my stablecoin balance is instantly usable for buying groceries or paying rent?
Exactly. Users can now make direct, instantaneous payments using their stablecoin balance to essential local rails like Mercado Pago in Argentina and PIX in Brazil. This completely eliminates the need for expensive card processors, unfavorable exchange rates, or slow bank transfers. It links global digital dollars directly to essential local commerce infrastructure.
And we have to emphasize the sheer scale of the PIX integration in Brazil. This isn't just some niche app.
Not at all. PIX is not just another payment app. It is Brazil's financial operating system. It's used by over 76% of the entire Brazilian population, and it processes 80% more transactions than credit and debit cards combined.
And Mercado Pago is huge in Argentina.
Huge. It boasts 72 million active users. This integration immediately turns stablecoins into instant, low-cost utility for two massive economies, solving persistent problems like card rejection and high cross-border transaction fees for anyone holding digital dollars.
It's incredible to see that level of adoption and utility being built while the price charts are just flashing red. However, as AI and distributed computing expand, so does the sophistication of criminal activity. We have to address the growing threat of crypto mining malice.
This is a significant security warning that hits directly at the infrastructure enabling the AI boom. A botnet, which is being tracked as IronEarn 440, is actively exploiting a critical unfixed severity flaw in Ray clusters.
And Ray, for our listeners, is an open-source Python network. It's designed to distribute computational workloads across multiple machines, which makes it essential for AI development and data processing.
Right. So attackers are hijacking this specialized computing power that's intended for development or AI tasks to mine crypto for themselves.
And they're using AI to do it.
Precisely. The attackers are using AI-generated payloads, ironically, leveraging the same technology they are undermining, to submit jobs via the unauthenticated jobs API in these Ray clusters. The payload then deploys the XMRig cryptojacker.
And their method of deployment is highly refined to avoid detection, correct?
Yes. This is the clever part. To avoid the easy detection that usually happens when a cryptojacker consumes 100% of the processing power and drastically slows down the host system, the attackers are locking XMRig to just 60% of the victim's processing capacity. It's a very clever stealth tactic designed to keep the victim server operational and the theft running longer without anyone noticing.
How widespread is this vulnerability, given how much Ray is being used in AI now?
The research indicates an alarming spread. Over 230,000 vulnerable Ray servers are now exposed online. This is a huge increase from only a few thousand exposed servers that were reported back in 2023.
So the dark side of the AI boom.
Absolutely. Specialized computing networks are becoming massive, highly valuable targets for crypto mining theft, exploiting flaws in decentralized architecture.
It truly is the Wild West merging with the future. You have AI models trading our crypto, while AI is also writing the payloads used to steal computing power to mine crypto.
All this institutional commitment and technological advancement is moving in lockstep with global efforts to regulate and manage digital assets. It's a necessary step for mass adoption. We are seeing governance finally start to catch up to innovation.
Let's start at the highest levels of traditional banking regulation, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. Their chair, Eric Thedin, is demanding an overhaul of the rules governing bank crypto capital.
This is huge news for traditional finance integration. The current Basel rules are notoriously stringent. They require banks to hold massive amounts of capital. In some cases, it's dollar for dollar backing against their crypto exposure. The Dean is calling for a major overhaul because these stringent rules are simply not working.
What specifically is forcing his hand now?
Two major factors. First, the dramatic increase in stablecoins, which fall under some of the most stringent Basel capital requirements. Banks want to engage with stablecoins for payments and settlement, but are financially penalized by the rules for doing so.
And the second factor?
Resistance. Resistance from key global financial centers, specifically the U.S. and Great Britain, which have effectively refused to enact the current stringent rules.
Why did the U.S. and U.K. resist implementation?
Well, the industry criticized the original Basel rules as being too punitive and too conservative relative to the actual risks presented by holding high liquidity assets like Bitcoin. By delaying and resisting implementation, the U.S. and U.K. essentially forced the global body to acknowledge that a different approach is needed, one that recognizes the growing stability and structure in the crypto market, especially in regulated stablecoins.
Moving to North America, we've seen rapid coordinated movement on stablecoin legislation. Canada just introduced the Canadian Stablecoin Act.
Yes, as part of its Budget Implementation Act. This is a foundational piece of legislation for them. It establishes a robust federal regime under the Bank of Canada to supervise all issuers of fiat referencing stablecoins available to Canadians.
And it requires a full registration process.
A very detailed registration application covering governance, financial disclosures, and reserve management.
And this framework is very familiar to U.S. observers.
It is modeled closely on the U.S. Genius Act, which was signed into law earlier this year. This highlights a coordinated, regulatory-confident North American approach to defining and securing stablecoins. This regulatory clarity is exactly what President Donald Trump championed as part of his pledge to make America the crypto capital of the world. And it shows some bipartisan progress on this specific issue.
Speaking of the U.S., the government is also making moves to severely limit the use of offshore crypto avenues, focusing heavily on tax transparency and reporting.
This is the IRS and the White House reviewing a proposal modeled after FBR and FATCA, the frameworks used for reporting offshore bank accounts and foreign financial assets. This new proposal would require Americans to report and pay taxes on foreign crypto accounts.
And the definition of a foreign account here is intentionally broad to catch as much activity as possible. How wide-reaching is it?
Extremely broad. It potentially includes offshore centralized exchanges, like those operating solely out of Asia or Europe. It could include foreign custodians, foreign brokers listing tokenized assets, and even certain foreign wallet providers that hold private keys outside of U.S. jurisdiction.
And what's the stated reason for this?
The stated rationale is not merely tax collection. It's to promote the growth and use of digital assets in the United States and alleviate concerns that the current lack of reporting disadvantages U.S.-regulated exchanges. The message is clear. The U.S. government wants crypto held and transacted through onshore regulated entities.
This regulatory momentum culminates in what is perhaps the most tangible sign of sovereign adoption yet: the integration of Bitcoin into municipal finance led by New Hampshire.
New Hampshire just launched the nation's first $100 million Bitcoin-secured municipal bond. This is not a speculative investment. It is a financial product backed by the security of a digital asset. The bond is a conduit bond led by the state's Business Finance Authority, or BFA.
So what makes this secure for the investors? And critically, how are the state's taxpayers protected from the underlying volatility of Bitcoin?
The structure is designed for maximum risk management. Bitcoin held in BitGo custody serves as the primary collateral to safeguard the investors.
Yeah.
If the BFA were to default, the investors are secured by that Bitcoin collateral, which insulates taxpayers from the market risk.
And this is part of a bigger state strategy.
It is. This bond initiative is a controlled trial, and it follows an earlier critical move that allowed the New Hampshire Treasury to allocate up to 5% of public funds to crypto. That created the first state-level strategic Bitcoin reserve.
The ultimate goal, then, sounds like converting idle reserves into functioning tools for public finance.
That's the long-term vision. The fees and gains generated from this collateral program will be directed into the Bitcoin Economic Development Fund, which supports local entrepreneurship. Experts working on the structure noted that it opens the door for pension funds and retirement programs to gain limited managed exposure to crypto through a highly regulated bond structure. This is how Bitcoin begins its integration into the multi-trillion dollar U.S. bond market.
Finally, we saw a key shift in direction at the FDIC this week that could ease access to banking for crypto firms.
Yes. Travis Hill, President Trump's pick for FDIC chair, was advanced by the Senate Banking Committee. Hill has focused on overturning the agency's direction on digital assets, specifically moving to end the practice of using reputational risk as a means to block crypto firms from financial services.
Which has been a huge problem for the industry.
A massive problem. For years, major banks have denied services to legitimate crypto firms, citing this undefined reputational risk, effectively choking off their access to traditional banking. Hill's advancement suggests the agency is poised to move toward a more objective, risk-based regulatory assessment rather than just subjective fear.
So if we synthesize all of this information from the sovereign wealth funds buying the dip to the exchanges filing for massive IPOs and the regulators finally trying to catch up, we see a market that is just fundamentally defined by tension.
That tension is undeniable. We see enormous institutional fear. You've got the billion-dollar Ethereum trust canceled, SharpLink facing a $500 million in unrealized losses, record ETF outflows. These are all signs of acute market pain and caution.
But on the other side, we have incredible institutional confidence. You have 89ish tripling its Bitcoin stake, treating it as a structural peer to gold. You have Kraken marching toward a $20 billion IPO backed by giants like Citadel.
And New Hampshire.
And New Hampshire launching the first Bitcoin-secured municipal bond, legitimizing BTC as collateral in public finance.
The market might feel chaotic and volatile in the short term, but the machinery underneath is rapidly maturing. The persistent effort to bridge crypto innovation, you know, AI models trading automatically on BitTrue, stablecoins paying via PIX in Brazil, GNOT revolutionizing hardware security with traditional regulatory guardrails like the overhauling of Basel Bank rules and the new Canadian stablecoin law, suggests we are solidifying the foundations for the next era, regardless of the price dips.
What stands out here is that despite the short-term price trauma, the technical and governance infrastructure is just moving forward as if the chaos doesn't matter. But we do have to acknowledge the one area where this market is deeply intertwined with broader economic forces, the global AI boom.
We've seen AI feed crypto trading. We've seen AI create new security threats. And the AI narrative in general is driving risk appetite among the major tech investors who also back firms like Kraken. The sources noted warnings from figures like Google CEO Sundar Pichai and JP Morgan, warning of irrationality and a potential bubble in AI valuations globally.
So here is the final provocative thought for you to consider. If the high valuations and speculative frenzy driving the current excitement in the AI sector, the very sector that provides capital and narrative confidence to the maturing crypto world, were to correct sharply, how might that global systemic correction affect the newfound structural stability that institutions like ADIC and Michael Saylor believe they are building into the Bitcoin ecosystem? What stands out to you about that potential spillover risk?